Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Happy to be here. Very pleased to be here to share some practice time together, to make some more Dharma connections on the island for myself, Dharma friendships. And I feel just very honored to have been asked. So I'm appreciating the opportunity to share some reflections with you today. And as Koshin was introducing me, I was realizing, as most of you probably know, the insight meditation kind of movement or stream arose from early Buddhism, so the Theravada lineage, so the flavor of Buddhism that sprang up in Southeast Asia. So most of my teachers studied with teachers in Burma and Thailand. And so I was thinking as he was introducing, so my influences on practice right now are that early stream of Buddhism. Preschoolers, people under 6, and people over 80. So I feel like I'm learning equally from all of those groups at the present moment. So I know that this month you're spending some time reflecting on Shila, so ethics, values, and sometimes I'll probably use the Pali, so Sila, so I'll try to give equal weight to the Sanskrit and Pali. So I wanted to just offer a few reflections on Shila. It's such an important topic and one that's dear to my heart. When I first started practicing 20 or so years ago, I have to admit that the teachings on ethics were not the most compelling for me. Right? So I heard a lot about this threefold training, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, or Shila, Samadhi, Prajna. And like many who start in kind of the Western scene, I had an acute sense of my own suffering, the possibility that I could at least better it or maybe get out of it. But I wasn't so interested in what seemed to me like codes of moral behavior. Right? The sense that I was sort of drowning and I could meditate out of myself. So a very kind of misguided foundation, actually, for starting practice, but that's how I began. But it really wasn't very long before I started to recognize two things in my own practice, just from sitting for longer periods of time, especially on retreat. One was that there was a very natural, organic kind of life review process that would happen on its own. So without me even searching or looking for it, I would naturally be remembering things, you know, back to as early as 7 or 8, sometimes when maybe I had been unkind to my brother, had said things that were less than skillful, and had never really processed or been with those reverberations or the consequences of that. So there was this kind of astonishing process of the mind, as it was clearing and settling, beginning to feel kind of the results retroactively after the fact. But I began to kind of trust this natural inclination towards more skillful behavior and clearer seeing. And the second thing that I noticed was that my kind of in the moment, in the world sensitivity to the effects of my, not only my actions, but my thoughts, my inner speech, the time lapse between when I would experience something sort of unskillful, judgment, some elements of fear, and when I would feel kind of the reverberations or the consequences of that, that kind of time lapse between those two was shrinking all the time. So I would be walking down the street and feel just a very reflexive form of judgment, and could feel my inner energetics contract immediately, as though not only was I potentially harming the other person, but it hurt. Right? So it hurt to do things that were unskillful. So I really began to kind of develop an interest, but also a trust in a kind of deepening sort of ethical inclination. So I like the term ethical sensitivity. So it's not a solid block, the unchanging block of codes that we swallow and never examine, a static thing that we try to live up to, but it's a deepening sensitivity to cause and effect, to how everything we do, everything we think, everything we say, everything we act out in the world has this reverberation that can be felt inner and outer. So this is not unlike pregnancy for those who've been pregnant or been around ones who have been pregnant. You have this refined, often sense of smell, right? That leads to a very heightened intuition about what you need to avoid. Right? This is protective. Those garlic and onions are revolting, and I'm not going anywhere near them. Right? So it's a heightened sensitivity that's meant to protect our inner life that's developing. So this is similar in some ways to the ethical sensitivity that gets heightened with practice. So the Tibetan master from the 4th century, Padmasambhava, said, one's view should be as wide as the sky, and one's conduct as fine as barley flour. So I was saying this to my husband the other day. He's like, barley flour? Is that really fine? What is that? But you get the idea. We can have the widest possible view. So our understanding, our experience of emptiness can be vast, deep, and penetrating, but still our commitment and our attention to the precision of our conduct can be very fine, needs to be at the level of the nitty-gritty. So I've heard recently that the Dalai Lama has been quoting this in response to, when he's asked for his response to Buddhist teachers behaving badly. So have the widest possible view, but our attention to conduct really needs to be very fine. Otherwise, it's just a good idea, right? It's not really an embodied understanding or embodied truth. It's just a beautiful ideal, right? So this has been striking for me. So as part of the Buddha's map of the mind, he highlighted two qualities that are really at the heart of this ethical sensitivity. And this is one of the things that I find inspiring and amazing about the Buddha's teachings is, again, this level of precision and detail at which he could identify certain aspects of our mind-heart that were good to pay attention to. So before MRIs and neuroscience and all this research, a very detailed map. Like this is kind of our makeup. So we can investigate this for ourselves. These two qualities that he identified as being at the root of our ethical sensitivity, he called in Pali, and I think they're descriptive in Pali. So hiri and otapa, or otapa. And he called these two the guardians of the world, because when they are developed, when they are intact, when they're not covered over by greed, hatred, and delusion, They keep not only our internal sense of integrity and alignment steady and strong, but they also keep kind of the social fabric of our communities and our shared life intact, right? They protect us inwardly and outwardly. So early on, these two qualities had a bit of a translation issue, as many often do, and they were translated as moral shame and moral dread. So, not exactly like bestsellers in the marketing field, especially for Westerners. So if we had put out on that board, moral shame and moral dread, come on Sunday, you know, it wouldn't have been so effective. But this is worth teasing out a little bit. So here is the sense in us that doesn't want to go against our deepest values, our deepest integrity as a human being, that doesn't want to act or speak in ways that are in some ways unworthy of us. And otapa is kind of the reticence of the consequences of acting in a way that is less than skillful. So what would be the social consequences, you know, of lying, stealing, exploding in anger, just getting sloppy? What will the reverberations be in this community, in this group? Will I lose relationship? Will I lose respect from people, especially that I value? So you could see that the difference between kind of a moral shame and dread and what later was translated as conscience and concern, right? So an inner conscience and an outer conscience. Inner conscience being kind of the loyalty to this inner sense of integrity and concern about the reverberations in my community. So these two act as protectors, as guardians. But we always have to be careful that it doesn't slip into this kind of more moral shame and dread, get confused with that. So in my own reflection, moral shame and dread arise when the small, separate sense of self really starts to identify with a pattern of behavior and take it as a solid identity, as a solid sense of self. So one of the similes that the Buddha used for these qualities are the very dramatic simile was an iron rod that on the one end is covered with excrement, and on the other end is burning red hot. So kiri would be the sense of kind of recoiling and withdrawal we would feel about touching the end with poop on it. And also the kind of fear that we might feel grabbing something that was red hot. Right? So very dramatic, but you can get sort of a visceral sense of the way in which we might withdraw from actions that are out of alignment. A feeling of a queasy, oh, don't want to go there, and a real sense of potential harm that could be caused externally. So when we get this confused with identity view, with identifying with, I think, either end of the stick too strongly, we think that we are kind of the depraved, shitty end of the stick, for better or worse, we get that confused with who we are. And so we get stuck in really unhelpful loops of guilt and shame that if we follow them, do not lead anywhere helpful. These are afflictive states, right? Downward spirals. If we confuse that with who we are, we can pile guilt and self-recrimination and retracing past mistakes over and over and over again. This doesn't lead anywhere. So to be careful where the sense of self can really congeal around these more innate, kind of pure qualities of heart. To get at this a little bit, think it's helpful. Here's a preschool example. So one of my son's early preschool teachers was very clear that he wanted to, he would say, this was in Seattle, his name was Tom Hobson, he's a Dharma teacher in disguise, and he would say, my primary goal as a teacher is not to teach obedience, blind obedience to authority, but to help foster fear of the right things in the kids. Right. So fear of the right things being primarily causing harm to one another and fracturing the community. So he's giving this example of a girl and a boy on the playground. He says, yesterday a girl with whom a boy regularly plays shouted at him, "You hit me. I'm not going to play with you anymore." Then she marched off. I was not too far away, but neither of them so much as looked in my direction. As he watched her walk off, I saw him fighting back tears. After a few minutes, he chased after her. They were too far for me to hear what he said, but I did hear her response, "You hit me. I don't want to play with you anymore." He dropped to the ground right there, overwhelmed with remorse in a way that never happens when we adults are involved. Sometimes we must step in, but when we do, one of the risks is that we shift attention away from where it ought to be, the hitting and its natural consequences, and turn it on ourselves. The authority figure stepping in to insist upon compliance. In this case, he was left face to face with his remorse. I don't know if he ever apologized, but by the end of the day, she had forgiven him. I know this because I saw them once more playing intimately with one another, friends again. So when we're in touch with Hiri, Otapa, there's a natural, healthy remorse when we've made a mistake that's onward leading. It doesn't lead us down a shame spiral of self-denigration, but it gives us the opportunity to repair in the present, but also to kind of recommit ourselves to learning and to acting differently in the future. I saw a bumper sticker on a car on the ferry the other day that said, "Always make new mistakes." So we have tremendous potential to choose differently, to learn and choose more wisely. So, Hiri and Otapa, when we're in touch with them, this conscience and concern, they give rise to a very healthy pause, right? And this pause is, it's so essential. So they give rise to a healthy caution when we're, the Buddha would talk about it as heedfulness, when we're in relationship with other people. And in this pause, really, everything is possible. I'm saying every new action is possible. So to appreciate that these ripen in healthy caution, healthy remorse, heedfulness, the pause. And one more example of this. So this is a poem from Mary Oliver. And in a culture that tends to value kind of competition, performance, like the intellect, what we can have, get, make, produce, we're often feeling a sense of shame in all the wrong places, right? We're feeling shame for aspects of ourselves that don't live up to some standard that we may not even agree with. But that will come up again and again. And every time we feel that our actions not aligning with our behavior, I think there's really an invitation there to look more closely. So there's always a little bit of heartbreak underneath those actions, right? There are plenty of times in which we sense what would be most helpful, what would be beneficial for ourselves and others, and then we just do otherwise. Anyone experience that this week? So there's our place of inquiry and examination, right? wherever we're not lining up. So what is there in the heart that I need to attend to more fully, more deeply? So I think there's a lot to share about this, but I'm sensitive to time. So just also an awareness of the wisdom that these two can balance each other. So it's a system of continual inner feedback and outer feedback. And when these are in balance, we really have a sense that our inner sense of self-respect, our inner goodness, is reflected outwardly. And outwardly, hopefully if we're in communities especially that reflect our deepest values, that we're also receiving kind of external feedback of where we might be out of alignment. So the internal and external are reinforcing each other. If we would put too much emphasis on outer respect, on valuing kind of that outer conscience or the outer consequences of our actions, but don't spend enough time with the inner reverberations, we can get off kilter. We can get sidled with a grim duty, just doing it because, you know, for the sake of the group, but not checking in internally. It can also make us really subject to influences that may not have our best interests at heart because we're only respecting outwardly. And contrarily, on the other side, if we're only checking in internally but not externally, you know, for myself, we can become very hermit-like. We can kind of go rogue, go our own way, but be in kind of a defensive posture against that kind of really invaluable outer feedback from the community. So both of these, when they can be balanced and informing and relating to one another, can be just ideal contexts for practice to develop. And the Buddha said that over and over again, that when these two are ripening and nourished and developing, then practice can unfold in quite a natural way. So I have the good, really the honor, quite a lot of being with folks as they are at the end of their lives. And just about 7 years ago now, I had the honor to be with my grandfather, my 98-year-old grandfather, as he was passing away. And he was someone with whom we could not have been different, more different politically. Just absolutely could never line up on that level of view. And yet he lived his life, lived in the same house for 60 years. He worked until a few weeks before his death at 98. And he lived simply. He baked bread, fed people, took care of people when they needed housing, was dedicated to his family, his community, was a very good neighbor. He lived frugally. And at the end of his life was one of the most amazing things that I've been a part of, that for the last week or so, when he was still lucid but weak, streams of people would come in to visit him and to pay their last respects to this person. And so I watched him every day, kind of really garner the energy to get out of bed, hoist himself up on his scooter, took everything he had, and listen to people as they came and expressed their gratitude and their appreciation. Many of whom were saying, "I'm worried that nobody like you will exist in the world anymore." And it was so moving to watch, because as he was receiving people, it wasn't, he didn't need their gratitude, but they were really benefiting from being able to express it. And so as he finally became less and less responsive, as many of you who've been around death know that it's like the face and a lot of the features kind of recede into the background often, and so much light coming through his eyes. And so still responsive. And so every once in a while, he wasn't speaking, but every once in a while he would open one eye, and this bright blue eye shining at me, and he would say, "It's all well, and I don't want to do one more thing." And it was so beautiful. It was clear. And then when he finally passed, I don't know what his state of mind was like. Can't speak for that. But I know the feeling of what was around him and what all of our family and friends could participate in, which felt like a field of blessing to be around. Right? It's like the goodness of a life, of a field that he had contributed to, and that others were then coming and expressing gratitude, contributing to. And it was just this very natural exchange. And so at the end, it was like a cedar tree just gently falling over and kind of supported by the foliage that was around it. It was just a lovely expression. But I think it speaks to kind of the potential of this balance of inner respect, outer respect, inner value, outer value. And when our inner sense of goodness is developing and we are practicing with it, it really feels more like devotion. And so in the end, it's like goodness bowing to goodness. Inner respect bowing to outer respect. And really, there's nothing else to do. It's the only thing that we can do in the end. Everything else contributes to the mess, mm-hmm. far as I can tell. So thank you. I think I've gone on a little too long. I really appreciate the opportunity to share some of this with you, and I hope some of it has been helpful and of use. And take it with you. So I'm really honored to be on the path together in this place, in this time. And thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.